This is The Conversation. Hi, I am Michael Shaw, and I welcome you. Thank you for being here. Eric Yonker today, couple of SoCal Jews going at it toe-to-toe. So that's coming up. Very exciting, very entertaining stuff, I think you will find. I want to thank all of the recent Facebook fans who came along with my last podcast with Rebecca Morris. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for joining. And I invite all of the Eric Yonker fans and friends to become Facebook fans as well. Getting likes on Facebook is actually something that will help grow the visibility of this project, so please do so. And you can find the link by going to theconversationartistpodcast.podomatic.com. You will find a link to the Facebook fan page there. You can also find a link to donate to the show. Donations are very much appreciated for this growing project. You can also find the Twitter page there, and you can find the email address in case you have any questions or comments. You can also find, of course, all the past podcasts that we have done, about 40 or so at this point. So one thing I want to add before we get to the conversation with Eric is he does mention his girlfriend a couple of times, and that is the artist Allison Schulnick, just so you know, in case you're curious. So that's about it. I thank you again for being here, and I think you're going to find this pretty great stuff. So let's get to that conversation with Eric Yonker right now. Talk to you soon.
Is that a light?
That's an animation table.
Oh,
yeah, yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what they
okay.
use as a circular disc. Yeah,
and
so that's
the last
from the old days.
That?
Wow, it's been probably too many years.
Right.
I mean, I use it as a flat surface. You know? But yeah, I even for the Seinfeld gig, I did it in Flash, you know. But it was basically when I was working on the commercials, and I would take some of the work home. Ultimately, what they didn't like about me being there in person was, I think, just being a principal guy. Like, I hate getting money for something that I'm not, like, working hard on doing. I think that's part of the reason why I work so many hours doing this. You know, even though art, I think, people think should be more of a hobby-type thing where you're having fun all the time, and it's like coloring books all day.
Well, of course, that is a myth.
It's a total myth.
It's a total myth.
Because,
I mean, I think, actually, yeah, I'm sure there's a conception from the popular sphere, which we're going to talk about, certainly.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think the other thing that you can try to debunk is people who actually have real jobs who are not doing their work. I mean, it's pretty hard to defend the intensity of labor in art when that's the alternative.
Well, absolutely, but it's also a headspace, too, because when art fills your headspace, even when you're trying to, like, beat off or take a shit, I mean, that's the thing about it, too. It's like, I can't sit down to watch a movie sometimes comfortably without my mind going, how can I use this, you know? And so, if you think about where you find relaxation from a job, granted, you know, you never worked a day in your life if you love what you're doing or whatever grandpa will say. I don't know what, it wasn't my grandpa, but...
No.
But that's the idea is, yeah, I do really enjoy it, but damn, it takes so much headspace. I mean, you only have so many, like, gigabytes, you know? And it's like, it's all that circulates sometimes. But I've gotten a lot better about it, or, you know,
right.
Now, you know, there's more, a little more space involved.
Well, you use the example when you're watching a movie. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Like, when you're watching a movie and you're thinking, how can I use this?
Mm-hmm.
I thought you were going to go to the place where it was... You're watching a movie and you're thinking, how can I solve this problem that I have going on in the studio? Which takes away from what you're actually doing in the
moment. That never actually does happen. That only happens when I put my head on the pillow at night. And I've never been much of a sleeper. Not much of a sleeper. But no, watching a film is definitely something I actively get into. Like,
right.
One thing I guess I've determined is I really hate it. Like, for instance, when my girlfriend seems to fall asleep every time we're watching a movie. You know, like, how can you not want to see this resolved? How can you fall asleep? Like, it's really not interesting. Even the shittiest movie, I want to know how it all ends, even if I could write it myself.
Right.
Like, it's so, you know, cliche or something. I go, yeah, I got to see this through. So I'm definitely focused when the movie's on, but I'm also thinking about, like, every film you watch is a piece of pop culture, you know? It's a piece of our history, a piece of someone's history, a bad example of filmmaking, anything that you can use, a shot that, well, it, for instance, if I'm talking about it cinematically in a way, my work is something that I've sort of coined the idea of elegant slapstick. And it's this idea where what you're seeing is photorealism in a way, but the same way you might see on a movie screen. I try to achieve like a glowing effect, the same way like a light projecting it behind, you know, like there's a projector behind this screen, and so you get this sort of glowing, soft haziness about. And that's what reality is. That I think that's how our corneas like perceive things. It has a softness about it. That, you know, nobody's like surrounded in lines. You know, but I just see moments in film that maybe spurn other ideas. You know, and I just want to make sure I'm always present. It's what I call observation mode. And I'm constantly in it. And that's what I mean about 24-hour gig. Like, you know, I eat, sleep, dream, shit this work. And most of the time, it's really hilarious fun, because what I'm working on is usually right. hilarious fun. But also, the ideas behind the work can also be deadly serious. I mean, it takes a lot of reading the newspaper to also understand what's going on around you in the world. And then be able to match it poetically, comedically, satirically with images from pop culture so that, you know, the masses can also absorb it and find treasure in it if they seek further, you know. But
well, let's go back to the place where yeah. we started, which was the animation table.
Because,
in fact, you, for a time, I guess it was a brief period, you were working for South Park, right?
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, from talking to you a little bit before, it sounds like it was not like a huge job in terms of your the arc of your work, because you were doing a lot of other animation things. But I just want to point out that I think people would see that, you know, in your bio, and they would go, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense, actually.
Totally right.
So why don't you,
yeah.
I think let's just get to the juiciest stuff. So
yeah, yeah.
What was it like working for those guys and in that environment? And this was like pretty early on in their evolution.
Well, it was, I storyboarded the bigger, longer, uncut film, and then worked on the show for a little while thereafter. But I ultimately was doing that while my second year at CalArts, so I had to, you know, focus on. I didn't make a film my second year. Instead, I made a South Park film. You know, so
right.
so.
How did you get the job?
Well, that's ultimately the thing. Is there was a job board at CalArts, and mostly it's just somebody wanted to make, you know, some like sexercise video or something in their basement. I don't know what. There was like crappy shit, you know. And instead, this job came along. It was like, the South Park guys need a storyboard artist. This is amazing. Like,
and you already knew about them at that time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they'd been around, you know, the show had been on for years. I mean, this is what, this would have been in 98, so the show had been on for a little while.
Well, they only started in, like, what, 96 or something like
Maybe
that.
You're right. You know, yeah. To be honest, I wasn't a fan of the show before I saw this job posting, but, I mean, I'd already had the experience of having to leave a very expensive school because I just couldn't afford it anymore, and, you know, wanted to try to avoid that. So
Before CalArts?
Yeah, I went to USC for a couple of years for journalism.
Right.
And then had to leave my third years to get rid of general education requirement stuff for $30,000 less. And I worked full time. You know, I was always working through school, you know, trying to pay for this thing. So CalArts wasn't any less expensive.
Yeah.
And so this job opportunity came up, and I needed money. So I was like, I'm going to go for this thing. But mostly because the prerequisite, one of the main prerequisites was not only did you need to have storyboarding experience, which I didn't have so much of at the time, but you also needed to be able to tomahawk dunk. So I didn't know exactly why, but when I got there...
Did you get to use a trampoline to do that?
No, I told them, I said... basically, one of the first questions asked of me was, so can you play ball? And I was like, well, I can definitely grab rim. I don't know about tomahawk dunk. Once in a while, I can dunk like a tennis ball or a volleyball or something, you know? But they're like, you're hired. there was a basketball league in Pasadena that they needed an extra man for. I guess somebody went down. I don't know what happened, but they needed an extra guy on the squad. So That was how I got hired on there. Yeah,
so that was the golden star in your resume.
That was the golden star. Was
your ball?
Nobody else apparently applying could play ball, and so I was handed a contract and a jersey. Yeah,
wow,
that's right. And 70% of the time I was there, it felt like, anyways, we were like out in the parking lot shooting hoops. But you know, of course, when the script pages would come in, then you know you had to do the. Basically, you're visually doing the script.
Yeah.
That's what storyboarding is. You're turning it into what South Park looks like. And, you know, we'd be, like, sweating on the storyboard pages and sticking to them and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, it was...
And then you would get revisions, and then you would have to go back. And,
absolutely.
And that's when it became those one of those all-nighter type of deals?
Yeah, eventually. You know, South Park was a pretty good working environment. There wasn't too much of that, you know... It was very professional. I mean, they were amazing to work for. I think in a way, well, ultimately over time, you find sometimes the first job you ever get in something. I had many other jobs, but it was the first animation gig I'd ever had. Would ultimately be the best one I ever had. And not to say that storyboarding was something that I would want to do as like my life's goal, but it was probably if anything in animation, what I was mostly built for. And you know, to make visual the written word, and
right.
That's exactly what I do now, anyways.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? Just to play fantasy for a moment,
mm-hmm.
What do you think would it have been like if you had just sort of continued to stay with the family and graduate, you know, to their version of CGI, you know, or their more complicated computer animation, and you know, sort of raising in you know, responsibility and whatnot with that group.
Well, storyboarding remains the same. Still hand-drawn. I mean, I don't see how you can turn that into a... I mean, I guess you could make
I think... Aren't they more recently doing computer storyboarding?
It's possible. I mean, I've been out of the game so long, you know...
Have you continued to watch the show at all?
I have to be honest, no. I don't, you know. I mean, I'm a fan of it, but not to the point, to the extent that I, you know...
Right.
I look at it this way: when I'm watching television, it's either news or sports, and I guess they probably cover a lot of news in South Park. But I take care of my own satire. I don't need somebody to do it for me. And you also don't want to be influenced by other comedians. Like I don't watch other comedians at all. It's a place I don't want anybody to say to me, "Hey, you stole that from me," and I don't want anybody to, you know, I don't know,
really,
to influence.
It's not an ego thing.
Not an ego thing. I don't want to be influenced by other comedy. I feel like I have a voice of my own, and I want to see it through. I don't know. Actually, watching comedy is mostly cringeworthy for me. There's fun things out there, and I've definitely laughed at comedy sets, but like stand up and everything. I'd love to be more supportive of it, but it's harsh, and I also see myself sometimes as the person on that stage. And I think that's what's so cringeworthy about it is going like, oh, I know how you feel, man. It's really shitty. It's really shitty when you get nothing out
right.
of an audience. And,
right.
You know, just
but then you're. But wait a second. You're always getting nothing out of an audience with art unless you're actually, you know, sleeping in the gallery, you know, watching everybody come in.
It's my cross to bear. I know. It is. I know. It's just such a ridiculous thing. You know, my girlfriend has said to me forever, oh, you should be, you know, you should be writing films for, you know, or you know, working on sitcoms or whatever it is that comedians are supposed to do other than stand-up. And I just have to say that ultimately I think I do have an interest in the visual form of comedy that political cartooning really satisfies in my mind.
Right.
Something my hero, when I started to understand what political cartooning was, is the LA Times' Paul Conrad, who was like multiple Pulitzer Prize winning political cartoonist. But again, I looked into that as a career option for me. I loved the idea of the, you know, daily 4 p.m. deadline, meaning you got to be snapping something out that has basically something to do with today's story and hopefully something that's even broader, but for the people who won't take the time to read the editorial, they'll at least look at the picture. You've got to summarize everything that's going on today in that image, and it's
right.
essentially what I do now, except I do it in a very glorified way.
Well, you know, we're at Eric's studio downtown, right down the street from Skid Row, up in the loft section.
Not even and, down the street, in it.
Okay, well, yeah, in it, but not in it. Yeah, in the Oasis adjacent to
It's called
Skid Row.
Sesame Row.
Sesame Row, got yeah, it, yeah. Okay. But yeah, I mean, you're out on the balcony, the patio, and the stairs here, and you got these, like, succulents, and it's pretty nice. Anyway, let's see if I can get my train of thought back. Yeah. Oh, shit. I think I just want to go, for lack of coming back to where we were before, I just want to go back to the beginning with you, because we've been talking for a while before we got on mic,
right?
And we didn't cover this at all. So where are you from?
I'm from L.A., Torrance, California.
Torrance, California?
That's right.
No shit. Yeah. So you're kind of from the belly of the beast, in a sense, and that's kind of why...
The only Jew in a born-again community, that's
no
right.
Kidding.
It's I lived in a land of Christmas, it felt like, to
is
me.
There,
yeah.
Is there? Is this all Torrance? Or when you were growing up, was there a section of Torrance that was
definitely
like
a section.
Born?
It was the South Bay. It's I lived in an area that sounds so much wealthier than it is, called the Seaside Ranchos. It's not by the seaside.
Okay.
It's close. You could walk there. It'd be a bit of a jaunt.
Right.
But it's a place where there's these Chinese elms that were put up by whoever built that suburb for probably like Boeing or whatever, or some refinery at some point that was there. And, you know, back in the 50s or 40s or whenever this whole area was built. And they planted these Chinese elms that, when I was there, was just mature enough for these Christmas lights to be perfectly strung down, you know, all the neighborhood blocks. And so everyone would come as far as the eye could see to drive through my neighborhood at Christmas time, the time I hate most every year.
Well, did your family, because of the environment
that
you grew up in, do celebrate both? Or,
well, yeah, I mean, we have a Hanukkah bush, looks exactly like a Christmas tree. We open up presents. I think a menorah was basically like blowing out candles on a birthday cake. You know, you make a wish and blow them. Yeah, I wish I'd had actually a little more of a... I would say ultimately I ride the pine of Judaism. I just sort of... I don't practice much, but...
I'm a Southern California Jew, too.
Yeah,
so, so, I mean, we celebrated both. Just, you know, more presents, and you know, we did sing songs, but I didn't have a bar mitzvah. Did you have a bar mitzvah?
I did not have a bar mitzvah, but I went to Jewish camp, which is the only reason I got laid in high school, so it was pretty great. Although some of those women, I will say, ultimately at 14, they got stubble from crotch to chin. Found that out the hard way.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, no, that's a...
How does this relate to your political comedy?
I don't know. Well, hey, it's not comedy at all. It's just the way it was. Hey, I was the only blue-eyed Jew for, you know... it's like Frank Sinatra rolling
so
up.
So in other words,
yeah.
You were... So you could you pass for a non-Jew?
I could pass for a non-Jew, absolutely.
Now I don't think you could pass.
Not so much, no, with all the facial hair? No, I don't think so, yeah.
Well...
I could pass for a Viking, too. What does that matter, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So even though you're kind of, like,
aping
the look of like, a West Coast rabbi slash Hasid right now...
Yeah.
...you grew up in a very more... much more of an assimilated form.
Oh, absolutely. Reform Judaism all the way. I mean, I'm two generations removed from when Judaism was the mainstay of our family. I mean, really... Ultimately, most of my family perished, you know, in Austria.
What countries are your parents
Austria
from?
And Russia. My parents are from, they both grew up in New York. They were both born there. So,
but their parents?
Yeah. My great-grandparents.
Okay.
But my grandfather, like, so basically his father was one of the only members of the family to have made the trip, you know, instead of staying in Austria, you know, so that's, and then the other was from my mother's side in Russia, basically. She basically, her great-grandmother, her grandmother left in order to not be in a fixed marriage, so she avoided the pogroms, but same kind of thing, like just avoiding something like that, yeah.
But is that something that your parents talked about when you were growing up?
Oh, I mean, it would be something more my grandparents would discuss, yeah.
And were they in Southern California, too?
Yes. My grandparents lived 100 yards from me growing up, you know. My dad's side of the family was all, inexplicably, they moved from Long Island to North Carolina. I still don't understand that move, but... A lot of the family, my dad's family is pretty huge. My mom's family is not as huge.
I guess I'm also trying to get a sense of whether you got, you know, the Holocaust guilt stories from your grandparents.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, I have a tremendous amount of guilt that I couldn't save one more with this Rolex I'm wearing. No, I of course, I mean, you always feel this remarkable sense of pride in a way that of being a survivor. So I see Judaism not so much as a religion, because I don't practice it in that way. I see it more as it's like a nationality. It's a source of pride. It's pride in one's heritage, if anything. I mean, I love Jewish history as much as American history, and I think you'll find a lot of that courses through my work. But I certainly don't wear it on my sleeve. And
how do you feel that said?
Yeah.
Not that I intend to take the piss from your relationship at all.
Yeah.
How do you feel about not the Jewish stereotype, but the Jewish, if you will, reality of the Jews in the industry? I mean, or is there such a thing? Are they just completely assimilated and therefore
in the art industry?
No, in the motion picture industry.
Oh, in the motion picture industry
and television.
Well. Yeah, I mean,
since you have been in the television industry for a bit.
I feel like they're doing a damn good job maintaining the industry. I don't know. Yeah, no.
No, I mean,
I want them to maintain their foothold.
You mentioned pride. Yeah, and now I'm talking about a type of pride that's a lot more ambiguous.
No, or ambitious, maybe.
Okay.
No, I like us to be the producing and directing class. That's exactly it.
Right, that's it. What type of Jew are you? I'm from the producing and directing
class.
That's right.
It sounds like a Mel Brooks line or something.
I'm from the doctor class.
That's right, yes. I like to also be the lawyer and doctor class. No, but it's rather than the Japanese conglomerate class that's certainly entered the fray of Hollywood.
Right.
But no, I think that if anything, actually bringing it to Hollywood, I would say that my take on history is sort of a Mel Brooksian take on history, and I've always, I think there's a definite Jewish sense of humor, a Jewish comedy that is not necessarily a lost art form, but one in which my work absolutely is a torchbearer. I think Jewish comedy is slapstick, is vaudeville, all those things that come into play from the Three Stooges, the Marx Brothers, Chaplin, you know, coming all the way through, you know, Rodney Dangerfield and Don Rickles,
right.
You know, and Mel Brooks, certainly, Woody Allen.
Before I get off your background, because I want to get a little bit more in, because we'll jump over to your work a bit, and maybe we'll come back, but what I want to know is, because you mentioned, you know, straight off that you were the only Jew, you know, in this section of Torrance.
Right.
Was that, were you assimilated in such a way that was a total non-issue?
Oh,
or
no.
Did you ever get picked on?
I only got picked on when I took a trip with an artist community to Salzburg. I had a show in Salzburg with a bunch of other artists, and realized that there's still places on the earth that are so anti-Semitic. It's pretty disgusting, actually.
What happened?
Well, just you go to a beer hall, you know, where like tables are long enough to fit 1,000 in Lederhosen, and go in looking like me, and see the reception you get. Yeah. It was like a saloon where I don't know why a saloon would have vinyl, but like where the you know, you hear the and everybody shuts up and like, you know,
everybody turns and faces the door.
Yeah, like, what's this guy doing here?
Right.
I never felt, and of course I have like this Hebraham on my arm, which probably didn't help matters. But
what's the sword? Let's talk about that. So you have, let me say that.
This guy.
So you have Abraham Lincoln with sort of his torso as a Star of David.
That's right.
So what's the story behind that?
Abraham. Well, it's kind
Abraham.
Of the,
you call
yeah,
him.
Yeah. That's what I call him. But
okay.
I love the idea. Well, first, every tattoo I have is mostly because my girlfriend wants to get one, and she says, "Come with me, get something. Come on, I'm gonna get a gummy burger on my wrist. Why don't you get something? You know, that kind of thing." And I say, "Okay, I'll think of something. Yeah, sure, I'll get something. Why not?" And so. Mostly, this idea just came the night before I walked in, and I was like, I'm thinking, for some reason, I was thinking about Lincoln and how everybody tries to claim him because, you know, an atheist you can't possibly have been an atheist in his time, for one thing, and you can't possibly have been as great a person as he was, or great leader that he was, without having to subscribe to some sort of godlike form. Uh-huh. So since then, everybody's tried to figure out what he was rather than what he actually is, which is nothing. And so even the gay community is trying to claim,
right,
you know,
the log cabins. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah. I figured, hey, I'm going to ink in my claim, you know, before
right.
somebody wants
right.
changes my mind about what, you know, maybe I'll get a gummy burger on my wrist too. But
so your girlfriend dragged you in with her while she was getting a tattoo, and then you proceeded to go down a series of getting several.
Well, yeah, I mean, now I have several, yeah. But I'm as shameless to get even some of my own artwork on me. I mean, I liked it enough.
Do you have some artwork on
me? I do,
where?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is a piece of...
Okay,
you did
a drawing of that.
I drew it, and, you know, he did a really good job on it, but I think, right. you know, that's the competitiveness. Like, when you bring in a drawing, and they go, oh, shit, I gotta do this good, I'm gonna look like a jackass. You know?
So yeah. This begs the question, of course, are you... I think you said your dad doesn't give a shit, but... Are your parents more disappointed because of your tattoo, your numerous tattoos, or because you haven't gotten married?
Oh, well, it depends. Yeah, you're right. Gender has everything to do with it, meaning only the women care.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I think whenever something like that comes up, I'm always like, you know, Tevye and Fiddler. I always say, tradition, you know, like, give me a break. I'm not going to be buried in a Jewish cemetery because
right.
of this.
Right.
At least I have a Star of David on me, for crying out loud. Tattoos for Jews for tattoos,
right,
whatever
right,
you call them.
Right.
But yeah, no, I think at this point, although the religion really was, are you going to make money at this or not? So it's like... Now that that's working,
so you're a good Jew.
I'm okay.
You're a good son.
I've done all right. Now it's okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to make them out to be...
No.
They've become a lot more supportive since it's worked. I'll say that.
Right.
You know?
Could have... Well, do you think Southern California Jews, though, generally are going to be, you know,
blonder?
More open-minded and liberal than East Coast Jews in terms of tattoos and marriage and whatnot?
Yeah, I mean, we're to the point where
they're... Because we're more assimilated.
Yeah, to the point where I understood in Brooklyn that some of the Jews were painting out the bike lane lines on the street because girls in short skirts were riding, hipsters in short skirts were riding by their communities.
The south side of Williamsburg.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I didn't see any of that, especially, you know, being down at the beach a lot and on the Strand, you wouldn't find that happening.
Right.
But,
right.
No, actually, my family and I are, we ogle together. We love short skirts.
Right.
No, actually, the great thing about my family, I will say this, there was a lot of laughter, always a lot of laughter. I'd probably say less since my grandfather passed away. He was as big a comedic mentor to me as anybody. I think I massively respected him, and he just was sort of like the glue that my family stuck together around. And, I mean, he was my first comedic... experience, I would say.
Was he like a Henny Youngman type of guy? Or what?
I guess you could say more. I mean, ultimately, you find out later a lot of the things he quoted were from films that I've now seen. You know, but it was so funny to me, and he had such a great spirit, and that's what I mean about the Jewish comedy. It's from a different place. Like, you're not going to find that in Southern California, but he's straight out of, you know, Brooklyn, and this comedy just was so foreign to me and to everyone I knew. That in a way, I mean, it's exactly what I do today, but I never lived it there, you know, and I'm not, it's a torch that's been passed to me, but in its own form, so, you know, I'm not saying I'm this new wave of, you know, it's like post-Jewish comedy, or I don't know what you would call it, but all I know is I absolutely respond to Jewish comedy, whatever that is. And I think that, you know, most people, when you say Jewish comedy, most people will nod and say, yeah, I know what that is. Well, Jews will anyways. But, like, I have this fight out with, you know, British people. They'll always say, oh, all Brits are part-time comedians. But I say all Jews are full-time, you know. That's the way it is with my family, at least, you know.
Right.
So that's been my experience. There were dinner table conversations. There was no place you couldn't go. You know what I mean? I find that, you know, like the gross out humor or the sex humor or whatever it was, there was nothing that wasn't open. So in terms of tradition, I think, you know, I don't know what it's supposed to be around a typical Orthodox Jewish table, but I feel like there was always a position within the community that it's okay to make a fart joke here and again, you know. But
I'm interested before you mentioned before the, you know, the separation that you want to keep because, you know, you sort of have your own archive and cinema, mm-hmm. you know, and TV and stand-up comedy going on, and you mm-hmm. kind of don't want it to be muddled by these things on the outside. So is it open enough so that you would be interested in like their, you know, their whole Mormon Broadway show?
Yeah,
I mean, some curiosity around that, or you know what I mean?
I have to be honest. No curiosity. I think ultimately that's the thing is when there's other, not to put myself in the class of genius or something like that, but when there's other geniuses out there is the way I look at it. I don't want to be influenced by them in any shape, any way. You know, like I can say I respect a voice like Oscar Wilde more than anybody I can think of, just in his wordsmithing, a silver tongue approach to mm-hmm. the language.
Right.
But if I read every word that he's ever written, I don't know. Like I feel like that then becomes part of your output.
Right.
I want my voice to be original. And maybe I cross over things that other people are doing. But I do feel like I. What I do is I take in everything that's happening in the world to develop comedy. It's like I take in very serious things in order to develop very comedic things from them, rather than the other approach is to take in a lot of comedy so you can say funny things. I want to take in deadly serious things so that I can find funny things to say about them. That's my approach.
Right.
So it's more the Paul Conrad political cartoon approach than it is... You know.
Well, what's interesting in the context of what you're talking about is that we were talking earlier about how you came to fine art, contemporary art, you know, sort of after going through the journalism, the political cartooning, and animation.
Right.
And so you kind of overdosed, in a sense. Not overdosed, that's not the right word. You overlearned, is that the what word you used?
I would say so, yeah.
On art, you know, in a very short amount of time.
Right.
And so the obvious question then is, how do you not have other art do what you're talking about that you don't want this other comedy to do to your art making?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I feel like being a comedian, I don't know if that's a title that you can use in life, because I don't consider that a job, so to speak, being a comedian. I mean, you either are or you're not funny, you know? That's developed in the playground sense. So, but in terms of art, I guess I came into it in a reactive way, reactionary, however you want to call it. Like, I wanted to be impressive. I wanted to be seminal right off the bat, but I know you need to, like, put a lot of years in, so that's why I stayed in underground and I was doing these things that were like long-term projects and just trying to be really serious about this craft because I didn't understand it. That's what I mean about art being this place that catches you before you fall off a cliff. I thought you had to be something else to be an artist. That's my left-brained approach when I realized that I had to be myself to be an artist because that's what people want. The minute I start being myself is the minute everyone took notice. I shouldn't say everyone, but the people that
have.
Well,
how are you not being yourself before?
By being reactionary. Yeah.
Can you give me an example of like a work that you might have done that was reactionary?
Well, I mean, the first thing I ever did as an artist, when I said, okay, this will be on my business card, I'll be an artist now, whatever that means, the proverbial, like, if I'm going to call myself an artist, then I've got to, like, get serious.
Well,
you know?
This is interesting because, I mean, unlike, I think, everybody else that I've talked to, you really did sort of make this hard right or left turn, if you will, from animation and political cartooning to art. So it really was this kind of dynamic.
Well, hard journalism, actually. I don't want to, like, debase political cartooning because I was learning the craft of journalism, which in and of itself is something that's, you know...
I'm not debasing it. I'm just saying that you had these two different, you know, backgrounds.
No, I know you're not debasing it, but I just want to call it what it is. It was a serious journalistic pursuit, I'll say.
Political cartooning slash journalism.
That's right. Yeah.
So you made this turn, and so because it was such kind of a quick turn, one of the questions that you were grappling with is... I'm an artist now. What does that mean?
How do I
contextualize myself so that I am now actually an artist and not one of these other things?
Well, I bought into the mythology too that artists were having more fun than I was doing what I was doing. I bought into that. And how did I buy into it when the first things that I were doing was absolutely zero fun? Right. I mean, it was like I didn't know what I was thinking, I didn't know what I was doing. But I guess the idea is you had to start somewhere. And if anyone I thought was going to take me seriously, I had better do serious things.
Well, what was what was an example?
Well,
of
the first
reactionary
thing so the first thing I ever did is I had this I guess it was like a shirt from the Gap, and it was like this really tight. Pinstriping on it, and maybe something I would have worn in the early 90s, I don't know, but it just happened to be in my closet. Like I say, I look around my studio and say, what can I do with anything? And so I started pulling all the threads out of it that accept the pinstripe, until ultimately it was just a spider web of pinstripe. And it took me, you know, like 2.5 months to do this, just like 11-hour days, 7 days a week.
So you just slip a needle in through all these holes and sort of...
No, it was it was like little nail scissors and tweezers. And I mean, it was a really delicate piece. I mean, it turned out really beautiful. I mean,
what does the final piece look like?
It just looks like, imagine a whisper.
Okay, got it.
No
more.
It's really delicate.
But that doesn't sound reactionary. I mean, I'm not sure.
Well, no, it's reactionary to a comedian to say, like, this was art.
I see. Huh.
No, you understand, like, for me, the art is comedy, but, you know, nobody wants to, like what are you going to call Richard Pryor, Rodney Dangerfield, like, a comedic artist, you know? I always say this, like, if Beyonce Knowles can be called a recording artist, and, like, the people at Subway are sandwich artists, then, like, what is a comedian, you know? But nobody wants to be called a comedic artist. That sounds like a pussy, you know? Ultimately, like, welcome, comedic pussy Dane Cook, you know?
So you were kind of having a little bit of a semantic inner dialogue about, you know, how these titles or, you know,
labels. I guess ultimately, I just didn't understand a fucking thing about art. And,
you covered a lot of ground quickly.
I did. I've come, well, thank God I have, in my vicinity, a real artist, because I still to this day, I mean, I've remarked many times that, like, maybe I'm the brains of the operation, but my girlfriend's absolutely the heart. Like, I feel like my heart is basically just an extra set of testicles or something. I don't know what it is, but it's, you know, yet to drop. But I everything I do, I don't want anything weepy. I don't want anything sappy. It's look, I'm delivering hard news in a satiric way. That's what I'm doing. And, like, that's true to me. That's what I love.
But the irony is, I don't know if this is the right, irony is the right word, but myself, and I presume a lot of your, the viewers of your work, are taking in comedy. They're not taking in politics.
And that's that's
like
what I want.
Is that a spoonful of sugar kind of thing, do you think, for you?
Well, there's red herrings all the way, but I also say many a time that there's a shallow end, there's a deep end. And like I said, you could dip your foot in the, you know, piss-soaked kiddie pool, or you can throw on the floaties and come out to the deep end with me, because there's tons and tons of treasure to be found there. Tons of treasure. And I develop a thesis for every show I do. I consider where I'm showing geographic location as much as the location itself, meaning the walls, the nooks and crannies of a gallery space. I use supermarket psychology to lead the viewer's eye around it. So much goes into a show that I'm doing, and I love that reaction that just passes it off as a one-liner. But ultimately, maybe that's still to some degree reactionary, in that I'm putting so much effort into something that looks like it's just a set of jokes. And I think, like I said, you take in deadly serious things to make comedy. I don't know, like, I'm glad that there's treasure in the work, but I'm also glad to have the reception that doesn't need to be that. You know, I like surface value too. I like it to be something that you can just have accessible and get into, like, oh, you know, there's Moses in his panties, you know, that's great. You know, I see Paris, I see Sinai. You know, I don't know, like, I'm...
Well, do you want to pick a work, speaking of Moses in his panties, but you can take any example, and just for listener's sake and my sake too.
Yeah.
What would be an example of one of those works where it obviously initially comes across as like, oh, you're combining these, you know, you're taking this icon and you're throwing some panties on him, and it becomes this kind of absurd thing. So take an example, anyone you choose, and then talk about sort of maybe the ideal viewer's perception of it beyond that, once, like, they get into the deep end.
Oh, well, I mean, like in my Cracks of Dawn show, this, like the cheese slice on garland, which is just a large slice of pizza on a garland of flowers. Right. I mean, it's a very aesthetic piece. It's beautiful, you know.
Very moist.
It's very moist, yeah. I really wanted to get that across. That's the deep end, is how moist it is. Yes. I wanted to, that's the conceptual understanding.
I think we've hit it.
You got it right off the bat. What am I even here for? That's amazing.
No, you know what's so funny? Because I keep wanting to bring this up. Because the first, I saw your work at the beginning. Yeah. I haven't seen much of it in person since, unfortunately, but... At 2008, they were at Light Projects, right?
Kim Light.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking earlier, it was 2008, but it feels like it was like 2004 or something. I mean, mm-hmm. it just...
March 2008.
It's now April 2012, and it feels like, you know, maybe because all the gallery changes and whatnot, but it feels like a long time ago for some reason.
Yeah.
But I remember... You know, the stack of pancakes with the eyes in it, right?
Yeah.
And then I actually had to look at an image online to remember the stack of papers that was Stephen, the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. But what did you turn it into?
Well, it's called American Socrates, and it's I rewrote the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People with my foot. And just
and you called it the Seven Habits of Highly Annoying People?
No. That was just called American Socrates.
Okay, and the idea, and obviously, see, this is the kind of thing that's definitely, it's a one-liner that immediately you sort of, you get on the slide and you think you're just going down a kiddie slide, but you're actually going down, you know, one of those hardcore.
Yeah, absolutely.
Slides,
yeah.
And you're splashing into, you know, if you're familiar with that book, it takes, so had you read the book?
I always fancied myself a double diamond or an emerald in Amway. Yes. Yeah, so I, if there was any family business, that was when where I thought I'd make my fortune.
Well, you mentioned that you're a very left brain person, and you mentioned just a little while ago that you arrange your shows with supermarket. You know, there's actually a word for it. I can't remember what it is, but it's this psychodynamic arrangement of objects.
Yeah.
So that kind of suggests to me that this marketing sort of sensibility or, you know, this A-type sensibility is something you have in you, even though you don't look like it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's another dichotomy that I... Right. Trust me, look at me. There's a surface value that looks like a joke, but inside, if you shave this...
There's a treasure.
There's lots of treasure to be found if you unzip enough.
but what was your popular perception of that book?
Oh, I think that... ultimately, I do sort of consider myself a coach... to some degree in life. Like if I'm always trying to bring the best out of people, I really want everyone to win. I want all artists to do great. I want everybody to do great in their field. Except for maybe like Hitler, you know, but I mean, I just feel like, that book is, if there's anything about, there's the word derivative, which I don't mind, but there's the word copying, and Stephen R. Covey basically just like rewrote How to Win Friends and Influence People, but just turned them into seven keys. I mean, it's been around forever. I mean, you could probably read this. I mean, every graduate of every business school gets a few of these under the tree at Christmas, I'm sure.
Right.
I mean, I literally did grow up in an Amway family, so that's not a joke.
No kidding.
But I mean, I came to understand what a joke it was.
Who sold Amway?
Well, my parents.
Both your parents?
Yeah, both thinking that somehow it would be like a retirement plan, but it ended up just putting a lot of soap in the garage.
Oh, shit.
You know?
So this is going to be like a transition to retirement kind of thing? Or?
Well, it was one of those things that, you know, you get swept up in. I understand, you know, how charisma can sweep an entire nation to kill another. It was like going to sermons. I mean, I was like 5 years old. You can't blame me. But, you know, it was the closest I've ever been to a church, was going to these Amway conventions. It was kind of ridiculous, you know. I remember somebody...
It must have been kind of scary.
I wouldn't say it was scary. I mean, I was the kind of kid that just adopted things and went for it, you know.
So, in other words, you really got... You kind of, like... drank the Kool-Aid to some extent.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that I was, like, trying to sell multivitamins to my classmates, but I thought, yeah, when I'm old enough, I guess I'll do this, you know? I don't know. When I was a kid, what do you do, you know? It wasn't like, because I also doodled in the margins of my homework, somebody was saying, hey, you know, you should do that. You know, nobody was giving me that. I don't blame my parents, because it's not like they came from it either. You know, they didn't graduate college. They couldn't tell me what it was like to do that route. You know, I don't blame anybody for that. But there are also counselors at my high school didn't tell me it either. I mean, I definitely got a subpar public school education. But within that education, I think I also got a lot of pop culture street smarts that I couldn't have gotten in a private school education, because I've met a lot of those guys, and hey, our conversations go nowhere. Yeah. I mean, how am I going to sell this meth that I've developed here? You know, I mean.
Okay.
No, I mean, but obviously, you know, there's advantages, there's pros and cons to everything. I don't want to get into, like, what's the right or wrong education. You know, God forbid, if I should have children of my own, coming to that decision would be remarkable. To say public or private, I wouldn't even know.
Right.
You know, because for my genitals are the same, public or private. I don't even know what to do. Yeah.
Circumcised or uncircumcised?
I'm a Jew. You got to be stealthy. You got to be clean. Come on. Nobody wants to look at that.
Right. So getting back, though, to that show. So,
yeah,
I just, you know, it was a really iconic image. And, the pancakes with, you know, with the face.
The uncertain tall stack.
The uncertain tall stack.
Yeah.
Now, was that a motif where you have negative space basically as faces in waves? I know you did one with the beach, the ocean as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you have one now downstairs with a big stack of spaghetti, right?
Yeah, well, they're now stacking spaghetti.
Right. <Come on. laughs> But you've been using that motif, you know, through all your work.
Yes, well, right? I figured if anything, if you run out of ideas, I can at least just put faces on a bunch of crap. No, it's the study of iconography, ultimately, because we're the only, like separates us from, like, pubic lice is, like, the ability to see two dots and a line and see a face within it.
Right.
So, ultimately, that's what it comes down to, is celebrating our species.
Got it.
No, but, I mean, that's the backbone of an idea like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's... Since I saw that show, and that was like the first work of yours.
Well, it was the first work of mine that anybody saw.
Okay, well,
that was the first show I ever had.
So I caught the beginning of the wave. Well, here's an interesting thing. So we're gonna come down from the analytical and big picture that we've been doing,
right?
And just take an interesting look at your professional life, because you had that show in 2008, which again feels like a long time ago.
It does.
And I haven't seen your work, and I missed it. You had this big show that was in the beginning of 2011, but was there much activity that was going on outside of LA over those next few years, or was it kind of
on and off? I mean, I had a show in Brooklyn. I had a show in Paris.
Where in Brooklyn?
At Jack the Pelican.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, how was that as an experience?
Well, I'm not... They no longer exist. I had a lot of rough experiences with certain heads.
And that was one of them. And we were talking about this earlier. Yeah. You have a real vision for the way your shows want to look, and a real vision for what a gallery that you're going to show in is going to look like. So you've learned from a lot of bad experiences.
Yeah,
along
kind
the way,
of. I mean, I really love the spirit of Jack the Pelican. I mean, that's the thing about it is, depending on who you are in the art community, I don't like to judge hip factor when it comes to galleries. But I mean, it was definitely the quirkiest gallery you could think of, and there was only so many places that I felt could not only get into my work, but you know, would sort of thrive with it. Like, this is for that scene. Jack the Pelican, Don Carroll over there walked an incredible tightrope of, I think you could see the worst things on earth imaginable there, as much as you could see on another show the most genius things out there, like Peter Kane and his animatronic sculptures was one of the biggest reasons I said, hey man, this place looks like for me. And I don't know, I wish there was more of that spirit, because it is, everything's commodified, certainly. I don't want to get down on that. I mean, look, without it I couldn't continue to do what I do, and the reason they're not still open is you know, it's twofold, but mostly because it was hard work to sell. So
it's not a real collector heavy gallery.
Yeah, I mean, they were really trying to bring to the people right. what I think, you know, another vision of what art could be. And I like places like that, but they're few and far between and usually artist run. And I've seen it in back rooms of highfalutin galleries where people think that the word, or I should say it's a hyphenated word, but artist run is a joke. And, you know, I guess you could look as far as like Rena Spaulding's to find something that is thriving as an artist run gallery, but they're few and far between. But
What was the gallery in Paris that you showed at?
Jean Roch Dard. I'm sure I mumbled that one, but
and what was that experience like?
It was great all the way up until I had to get paid for all the works he sold. Yeah, and unfortunately that was a real difficult thing.
But you got it?
Yeah, I got it, but it took a very long time.
You didn't have to hire any lawyers, though.
No, I didn't have to hire any lawyers. I did fortunately have you know, another gallerist here in where at the time in Seattle on my side helping me, but ultimately it was you know, a lot of excuses were made, but you find out that some of the most enthusiastic people, the people that come out, you know, roll out the red carpet for you while you're in town, man. I mean, if they're in a different zip code that they know you don't have access to, look, I mean, they're going to like put out the fire that's right next to them. And I understand that. And it's hard to run a gallery, and I don't take anything away from people that do it. It's fucking hard. As hard as it is, I'm sure, to be an artist. But I think if you're going to have any relationship with an artist, I mean, it's not just going to be through the work. If you sell the work, you've got to immediately throw that check in the mail, and it's not yours. It never was, you know? And now it's easier than ever for an artist to sell outside of their studio if they wanted to do that because of the internet. I don't personally want to. I want to be in the lexicon. I mean, if you're selling out of your studio, you're not showing anywhere. You know, this work needs a place to be.
Right. And speaking of which, the Armory happened in March, correct?
Yeah.
So a little over a month ago now. And
it feels like longer.
Yeah, right.
It really does.
And
the New York Times.
Yeah. So the New York Times always does a piece on the Armory.
Right.
And one of the artists cited, and I don't think there was an image, but you were definitely name-checked and described in big fashion in that article.
Right, right.
And you got a lot of attention, even though the Armory was still going on at that point. Correct?
Right. Yeah. No, that was like the second day of the Armory.
Okay.
Yeah,
So I think people would be very curious to hear. First of all, let me just get this out of the way.
Yeah.
I think it's a little disconcerting.
Yeah.
The degree to which the New York Times influence is.
Yeah.
That said,
yeah.
I myself and others could not be happier for you and what it did for you. So talk about what that experience has been.
I tried to turn them away. I said, I don't want... Yeah, it was so disconcerting. I said, no, please. I don't want this kind of attention.
Right.
I don't know, man. I mean, I felt like the show that I had there... I mean, I got mostly really positive reaction. Of course, there was two kinds of reactions, and they all come from... inflection. It's like, oh, did you see that show? Or it was, did you see that show? So it depends on how you read the script.
Right.
But I heard both reactions, which
to
I
your
love
face?
To be. Well, you know, not everybody knows if you're around. I try not to stick around. Like, art fairs is not a place for an artist to be hanging around. You know what I mean? It's
only masochistic artists.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Like, I asked my dealer, I'm like, you don't want me to hang around, right? He's like, hell no, no. It's much easier if I don't have to like talk about your work with you here either.
Yeah,
anyways,
yeah.
Man, and I'm like, thank you, because I don't, you know, look, it's a meat market for art, and I'm okay with it, I guess, but I also wanted to put up a show that felt like, at least while you're in my booth, you feel like maybe you're actually in a real gallery setting. So I try to, you know, wallpaper the walls in art so that you're immersed as much as can be in that type of setting. You know, and also make a show that's thematic, that had an idea, that had a concept behind it.
Right.
Not just like a best of or something like that. I wanted it to be a real show in that context. Not everybody appreciates that, but I think that maybe was part of the appreciation, maybe from some of the press that I got. So
meanwhile, you have this show coming up in the fall at this gallery in New York.
What's
the gallery called?
The Hole.
The Hole, right.
Mm-hmm.
and which is right across the street from the new museum. Is
that Yeah, it's on the Bowery. Yeah.
How long was that in connection with the Armory show, or was it in the works before that?
It was in the works before that. Mm-hmm. It was actually from the Cracks of Dawn show. That Kathy Grayson came in to.
Right.
She happened to be in town for the Art LA that in 2011.
Right.
And then at the time, Charlie and I had already said, "Oh, let's do the Armory together." We didn't know if we'd get in, but I'm the type of person that takes a little while to make a show, so. I did it on spec, basically, hoping that it was going to happen. And then when Kathy wanted to do a show, she wanted to do it earlier, but I said, September 2012 is the best I can do. I mean, this was, all the way back in March 2011, because I wanted to have the Armory be there, even though I didn't know it was going to happen.
Right.
So, fortunately, it all worked out, and I'm glad it worked out this way, because it enabled me to make both those shows and pace myself in a way that, because I'd given myself such a hard time trying to meet certain deadlines, and I finally said no, September, way out in the distance, so that I would have the time to do what I really want to do rather than rush things.
Right.
Yeah.
And what's the title again?
The working title right now is Virgin Birth and Turf.
Virgin Birth and Turf.
Yeah.
Okay. And we've talked, if not in this conversation before we started,
yeah,
about your interest in political satire,
yeah,
and the political consumption that you have that then you sort of transmute into your work. Do you think that there's going to be a heavy election element to the context of your show?
I think
do you want it to be?
I think I wouldn't be doing my job if it wasn't. Because that to me is my job. I don't know. It's self-appointed, certainly, but that's what I'm doing.
Well, how did we start off talking this conversation? You mentioned what you... The slightly different term than political cartoonist when transferred to art making is what you like to call what you're doing now.
I guess it's just let's see. I think I know what you're talking. Oh, elegant slapstick? Is that?
No, there was another one I thought you used too about.
Well, I was talking about the brows. Maybe I'd coined a term about that, but.
Oh right, yeah.
My upper middle brow.
Right, yeah. You're making upper middle brow art, which is. Accessible enough for the whole juxtapose, and I wonder if I fucked this whole thing up, because the whole juxtapose crowd is listening to this conversation and we haven't been honoring them. How help me honor them, Eric.
Well, I don't know what the juxtapose crowd exactly is, but
I guess we haven't been talking like that much hardcore art world stuff, so maybe it's okay, but I want to be sure that this, because you're an upper middle brow.
Right, well, okay, so the idea is, none of us are stupid. There's a low brow and there's a high brow in art, and nary the two shall meet is the way it sort of seems out there, but there are definitely people...
There are exceptions.
...that are teetering on that line, and I think that more than ever... Look, it's the same in almost all creative pursuits, the music business included, that, you're between worlds and you can still find an audience because of the internet, quite frankly. The blogosphere, there's a way to sell out of your trunk now if you need to. The other word I have for artist is survivalist, because, I guess most artists would be able to find a way to survive doing what they do, even if paying for dental work with paintings or whatever it is. But that's the thing, is I just feel like I'm neither highbrow or want to be, and I'm not lowbrow or want to be. So what is the middle ground? Because I'm both to a degree, but I'm something else too. And there's a lot of the people who I really appreciate that are making art that are in that same category. So therefore, I've coined the term upper middle brow. If you can get both highbrow and lowbrow, what people find traditionally in those contexts, to come into the same space, that's the space I'm interested in.
Right.
And so Kathy Grayson has built... A gallery that I think can be that bridge. She formerly the director of Deitch Projects, which made a huge dent in the art world doing that. So I've always taken on that animator sensibility, where I want the most eyeballs on what I'm doing.
Right.
It's not for avant-garde,
sure,
but it's not also not for them. That's why I think I do, maybe in a reactionary way, build treasure into the work, so that at least if you want to be stimulated in that way, you can find more than just, you know, a cool drawing,
right,
of, you know, a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, you know, reading Irving Stone.
Perfect place to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Thanks for talking to me. I appreciate
it. Right on.
It.
Yeah.
And we're out.